8. Thursday afternoon on the lake. Jesus well knew that his apostles were not fully assimilating his teachings. He decided to give some special instruction to Peter, James, and John, hoping they would be able to clarify the ideas of their associates. He saw that, while some features of the idea of a spiritual kingdom were being grasped by the 12, they steadfastly persisted in attaching these new spiritual teachings directly onto their old and entrenched literal concepts of the kingdom of heaven as a restoration of David's throne and the reestablishment of Israel as a temporal power on earth. Accordingly, on Thursday afternoon, Jesus went out from the shore in a boat with Peter, James, and John to talk over the affairs of the kingdom. This was a 4 hours teaching conference, embracing scores of questions and answers, and may most profitably be put in this record by reorganizing the summary of this momentous afternoon as it was given by Simon Peter to his brother Andrew the following morning. 1. Doing the Father's Will. Jesus' teaching to trust in the overcare of the Heavenly Father was not a blind and passive fatalism. He quoted with approval on this afternoon an old Hebrew saying, "He who will not work shall not eat." He pointed to his own experience as sufficient commentary on his teachings. His precepts about trusting the Father must not be adjudged by the social or economic conditions of modern times or any other age. His instruction embraces the ideal principles of living near God in all ages and on all worlds. Jesus made clear to the 3 the difference between the requirements of apostleship and discipleship. And even then he did not forbid the exercise of prudence and foresight by the 12. What he preached against was not forethought, but anxiety, worry. He taught the active and alert submission to God's will. In answer to many of their questions regarding frugality and thriftiness, he simply called attention to his life as a carpenter, boatmaker, and fisherman, and to his careful organization of the 12. He sought to make it clear that the world is not to be regarded as an enemy, that the circumstances of life constitute a divine dispensation working along with the children of God. Jesus had great difficulty in getting them to understand his personal practice of non-resistance. He absolutely refused to defend himself, and it appeared to the apostles that he would be pleased if they would pursue the same policy. He taught them not to resist evil, not to combat injustice or injury, but he did not teach passive tolerance of wrongdoing. And he made it plain on this afternoon that he approved of the social punishment of evildoers and criminals, and that the civil government must sometimes employ force for the maintenance of social order and in the execution of justice. He never ceased to warn his disciples against the evil practice of retaliation. He made no allowance for revenge, the idea of getting even. He deplored the holding of grudges. He disallowed the idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. He discountenanced the whole concept of private and personal revenge, assigning these matters to civil government on the one hand, and to the judgment of God on the other. He made it clear to the 3 that his teaching applied to the individual, not the state. He summarized his instruction up to that time regarding these matters as, "Love your enemies, remember the moral claims of human brotherhood. The futility of evil. A wrong is not righted by vengeance. Do not make the mistake of fighting evil with its own weapons. Have faith, confidence in the eventual triumph of divine justice and eternal goodness." 2. Political attitude. He cautioned his apostles to be discreet in their remarks concerning the strained relations then existing between the Jewish people and the Roman government. He forbade them to become in any way embroiled in these difficulties. He was always careful to avoid the political snares of his enemies, ever making reply, "Render to Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things which are God's." He refused to have his attention diverted from his mission of establishing a new way of salvation. He would not permit himself to be concerned about anything else. In his personal life, he was always duly observant of all civil laws and regulations. In all his public teachings, he ignored the civic, social, and economic realms. He told the 3 apostles that he was concerned only with the principles of man's inner and personal spiritual life. Jesus was not, therefore, a political reformer. He did not come to reorganize the world. Even if he had done this, it would have been applicable only to that day and generation. Nevertheless, he did show man the best way of living and no generation is exempt from the labor of discovering how best to adapt Jesus' life to its own problems. But never make the mistake of identifying Jesus' teachings with any political or economic theory, with any social or industrial system. 3. Social attitude. The Jewish rabbis had long debated the question, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus came presenting the idea of active and spontaneous kindness, a love of one's fellow men so genuine that it expanded the neighborhood to include the whole world, thereby making all men one's neighbors. But with all this, Jesus was interested only in the individual, not the mass. Jesus was not a sociologist, but he did labor to break down all forms of selfish isolation. He taught pure sympathy, compassion. Michael of Nebadon is a mercy-dominated son. Compassion is his very nature. The Master did not say that men should never entertain their friends at meat, but he did say that his followers should make feasts for the poor and the unfortunate. Jesus had a firm sense of justice, but it was always tempered with mercy. He did not teach his apostles that they were to be imposed upon by social parasites or professional alms-seekers. The nearest he came to making sociological pronouncements was to say, "Judge not, that you be not judged." He made it clear that indiscriminate kindness may be blamed for many social evils. The following day, Jesus definitely instructed Judas that no apostolic funds were to be given out as alms except upon his request or upon the joint petition of two of the apostles. In all these matters, it was the practice of Jesus always to say, "Be as wise as serpents, but as harmless as doves." It seemed to be his purpose in all social situations to teach patience, tolerance, and forgiveness. The family occupied the very center of Jesus' philosophy of life, here and hereafter. He based his teachings about God on the family, while he sought to correct the Jewish tendency to overhonor ancestors. He exalted family life as the highest human duty, but made it plain that family relationships must not interfere with religious obligations. He called attention to the fact that the family is a temporal institution, that it does not survive death. Jesus did not hesitate to give up his family when the family ran counter to the Father's will. He taught the new and larger brotherhood of man, the sons of God. In Jesus' time, divorce practices were lax in Palestine and throughout the Roman Empire. He repeatedly refused to lay down laws regarding marriage and divorce, but many of Jesus' early followers had strong opinions on divorce and did not hesitate to attribute them to him. All of the New Testament writers held to these more stringent and advanced ideas about divorce, except John Mark. 4. Economic attitude. Jesus worked, lived, and traded in the world as he found it. He was not an economic reformer, although he did frequently call attention to the injustice of the unequal distribution of wealth. But he did not offer any suggestions by way of remedy. He made it plain to the three that, while his apostles were not to hold property, he was not preaching against wealth and property, merely its unequal and unfair distribution. He recognized the need for social justice and industrial fairness, but he offered no rules for their attainment. He never taught his followers to avoid earthly possessions, only his 12 apostles. Luke, the physician, was a strong believer in social equality, and he did much to interpret Jesus' sayings in harmony with his personal beliefs. Jesus never personally directed his followers to adopt a communal mode of life. He made no pronouncement of any sort regarding such matters. Jesus frequently warned his listeners against covetousness, declaring that a man's happiness consists not in the abundance of his material possessions. He constantly reiterated, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" He made no direct attack on the possession of property, but he did insist that it is eternally essential that spiritual values come first. In his later teachings, he sought to correct many erroneous Urantia views of life by narrating numerous parables which he presented in the course of his public ministry. Jesus never intended to formulate economic theories. He well knew that each age must evolve its own remedies for existing troubles. And if Jesus were on earth today, living his life in the flesh, he would be a great disappointment to the majority of good men and women for the simple reason that he would not take sides in present-day political, social, or economic disputes. He would remain grandly aloof while teaching you how to perfect your inner spiritual life so as to render you manyfold more competent to attack the solution of your purely human problems. Jesus would make all men godlike, and then stand by sympathetically while these sons of God solve their own political, social, and economic problems. It was not wealth that he denounced, but what wealth does to the majority of its devotees. On this Thursday afternoon, Jesus first told his associates that it is more blessed to give than to receive. 5. Personal religion. You, as did his apostles, should the better understand Jesus' teachings by his life. He lived a perfected life on your rancho, and his unique teachings can only be understood when that life is visualized in its immediate background. It is his life, and not his lessons to the 12 or his sermons to the multitudes, that will assist most in revealing the Father's divine character and loving personality. Jesus did not attack the teachings of the Hebrew prophets or the Greek moralists. The Master recognized the many good things which these great teachers stood for, but he had come down to earth to teach something additional, the voluntary conformity of man's will to God's will. Jesus did not want simply to produce a religious man, a mortal wholly occupied with religious feelings and actuated only by spiritual impulses. Could you have had but one look at him, you would have known that Jesus was a real man of great experience in the things of the world. The teachings of Jesus in this respect have been grossly perverted and much misrepresented all down through the centuries of the Christian era. You have also held perverted ideas about the Master's meekness and humility. What he aimed at in his life appears to have been a superb self-respect. He only advised man to humble himself that he might become truly exalted. What he really aimed at was true humility toward God. He placed great value upon sincerity, a pure heart. Fidelity was a cardinal virtue in his estimate of character, while courage was the very heart of his teachings. Fear not was his watchword, and patient endurance his ideal of strength of character. The teachings of Jesus constitute a religion of valor, courage, and heroism. And this is just why he chose as his personal representatives 12 commonplace men, the majority of whom were rugged, virile, and manly fishermen. Jesus had little to say about the social vices of his day. Seldom did he make reference to moral delinquency. He was a positive teacher of true virtue. He studiously avoided the negative method of imparting instruction. He refused to advertise evil. He was not even a moral reformer. He well knew, and so taught his apostles, that the sensual urges of mankind are not suppressed by either religious rebuke or legal prohibitions. His few denunciations were largely directed against pride, cruelty, oppression, and hypocrisy. Jesus did not vehemently denounce even the Pharisees, as did John. He knew many of the scribes and Pharisees were honest of heart. He understood their enslaving bondage to religious traditions. Jesus laid great emphasis on first making the tree good. He impressed the three that he valued the whole life, not just a certain few special virtues. The one thing which John gained from this day's teaching was that the heart of Jesus' religion consisted in the acquirement of a compassionate character coupled with a personality motivated to do the will of the Father in heaven. Peter grasped the idea that the gospel they were about to proclaim was really a fresh beginning for the whole human race. He conveyed this impression subsequently to Paul, who formulated therefrom his doctrine of Christ as the second Adam. James grasped the thrilling truth that Jesus wanted his children on earth to live as though they were already citizens of the completed heavenly kingdom. Jesus knew men were different, and he so taught his apostles. He constantly exhorted them to refrain from trying to mold the disciples and believers according to some set pattern. He sought to allow each soul to develop in its own way, a perfecting and separate individual before God. In answer to one of Peter's many questions, the Master said, "I want to set men free so that they can start out afresh as little children upon the new and better life." Jesus always insisted that true goodness must be unconscious, in bestowing charity, not allowing the left hand to know what the right hand does. The three apostles were shocked this afternoon when they realized that their master's religion made no provision for spiritual self-examination. All religions before and after the times of Jesus, even Christianity, carefully provide for conscientious self-examination. But not so with the religion of Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus' philosophy of life is without religious introspection. The carpenter's son never taught character building. He taught character growth, declaring that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. But Jesus said nothing which would proscribe self-analysis as a prevention of conceited egotism. The right to enter the kingdom is conditioned by faith, personal belief. The cost of remaining in the progressive ascent of the kingdom is the pearl of great price, in order to possess which a man sells all that he has. The teaching of Jesus is a religion for everybody, not alone for weaklings and slaves. His religion never became crystallized, during his day, into creeds and theological laws. He left not a line of writing behind him. His life and teachings were bequeathed to the universe as an inspirational and idealistic inheritance suitable for the spiritual guidance and moral instruction of all ages on all worlds. And even today, Jesus' teaching stands apart from all religions as such, albeit it is the living hope of every one of them. Jesus did not teach his apostles that religion is man's only earthly pursuit. That was the Jewish idea of serving God. But he did insist that religion was the exclusive business of the 12. Jesus taught nothing to deter his believers from the pursuit of genuine culture. He only detracted from the tradition-bound religious schools of Jerusalem. He was liberal, big-hearted, learned, and tolerant. Self-conscious piety had no place in his philosophy of righteous living. The Master offered no solutions for the non-religious problems of his own age, nor for any subsequent age. Jesus wished to develop spiritual insight into eternal realities and to stimulate initiative in the originality of living. He concerned himself exclusively with the underlying and permanent spiritual needs of the human race. He revealed a goodness equal to God. He exalted love, truth, beauty, and goodness as the divine ideal and the eternal reality. The Master came to create in man a new spirit, a new will, to impart a new capacity for knowing the truth, experiencing compassion, and choosing goodness, the will to be in harmony with God's will, coupled with the eternal urge to become perfect, even as the Father in heaven is perfect.